Welcome back to the No Win Scenario Podcast. This is Graham Gordon.
And this is Josh Liebman. Welcome to episode 5.
All right, Josh, let's jump right into things. So you're on another little adventure this morning?
Today I was a little bit close to home. I went to the lovely suburban metropolis of Richmond Hill, where I saw the Canadian Taxpayers Federation and Ontario Proud launch the start of their Kathleen Wynne Moving Company tour.
Okay.
The Canadian Taxpayers Federation, they love setting up these trucks and driving them across the country to make points about, you know, spending. They're the guys who, they handle the national debt clock, which is just like this LED clock that's going up and up and up. So it's one of their patented media grabbing, attention grabbing stunts to talk
about. This is kind of like a conservative tradition too, right? Like, wasn't there, there's this conservative political operative in the States.
Jerry Nichols, huh?
Jerry Nichols wrote a piece like when this guy passed away. Do you remember?
Yeah,
he helped with like the Harper generation, right? Or like, actually, it might have been even further back than that.
Yeah, I know.
But he kind of started the tradition, right? Like of those billboards that really grab your attention.
Yeah. So yeah, it's another one of these trademark headline grabbing stunts, which was done to highlight how companies are being driven out of Ontario by high hydro costs, by forced increases in the minimum wage and such. So you have this big red moving truck with Kathleen Wynne's face painted on it, and it's you have interviews from these people who are owning this plastics company up in Richmond Hill, and they're on the record talking to local journalists about how they're getting squeezed out, basically, and how they had to lay off employees, and how it's not a hospitable environment in Ontario for small businesses. And they were afraid of, they didn't want to have, a forced minimum wage and things like that, and they were saying that there's a lot more administrative costs, and it's very specific to the actual company, right? They were talking about how the something about, and I didn't really get the context for this, but they were talking about how they had to apparently disclose all the names and the information of all of their employees and keep them on file, and that's a bit of a Privacy Act issue. And basically, they were complaining about how these changes were introduced without the government telling them they were going to introduce them. So we have a government who's kind of like changing the rules and moving the goalposts and, you know, making it up as they go along, which is a pretty consistent feature of how this government does approach to governing. So they're kind of feeling left out, they're feeling pissed off, they're highlighting how angry, and they're trying to show the real face of how Kathleen Wynne's policies are hurting Ontarians. So it's a nice piece of political theater.
Okay. You said the messaging was a bit muddled, though, or wasn't well understood by the crowd that gathered there?
Well, the problem with this stuff is you're talking about something you're trying to mix anger with facts, right? Which is something that happens in jurisdictions around the world, but you're trying to be like let's say I'm mad about something that affects me, and I'm trying to convince you that it's a big problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm upset about something that isn't specifically your issue, and you can kind of get like parts of why I'm upset, but then there are parts you don't understand, and then you got to sort of like condense this into a soundbite so that everybody can get this in the newspaper and read what's going on and understand why these people are so upset. And it's just, these changes affect everybody in different ways, right? So it's not that the messaging is so muddled, it's just that people, they are angry at this government, but what I may be angry at for a different reason than you are. And because people, it's so hard to get people on the same page, and there's differences between why they're angry, it tends to kind of get lost in translation a little bit.
Well, and there could be so many factors for why everyone's in the situation they're in now, right? Like the whole globalization factor too, right? And a lot of these people don't have the time to, or none of us really understand all the factors, right? So they kind of just latch on to one or two reasons for their grievances, maybe.
Effectively, yeah. And then you have these people seeing that this big red moving truck is parked in a parking lot. They see Kathleen Wynne's face on it. That's not something they were expecting to see when they woke up in the mornings. They kind of have to like figure out what's going on. They got to ask what's going on, what's happening, is this really going to change things, are you guys talking about moving Kathleen Wynne out of Ontario?
So they didn't have their 2 minutes of hate then that they wanted? People were more just like kind of confused why her face was on there?
I don't even know if the CTF in Ontario, but we're going for 2 minutes of hate. They were just trying to highlight how the Wynne government is trying to, it has through action or omission, made it very difficult for small businesses to operate here in Ontario. That's what they were going for. But as far as whether this is going to actually resonate or look like something that the government couldn't just brush off, that's another story altogether. Because you have random people coming up to this and spouting off about how what they're upset about with the government and saying, well, you know, we live in a banana republic, but what are you going to do, eh? Like, and it's the same sort of, I've heard this same sort of complaint that all the parties are the same, no matter what we do, we're screwed, so why bother? And just this overwhelming sense of hopelessness. To the point where people look at that at a truck with Kathleen Wynne's face and go, haha, that's pretty funny, but, you know, is this really going to change anything? I don't know. So it's not, it's
well,
like...
Well, didn't we have a bit of despair in our last episode when talking about Red Tories and how Patrick Brown's kind of lost direction?
Lost the plot.
Or he's not representing a real alternative at this point. So.
Yeah, and again, it's the same idea, because what a Red Tory is different from me to you. Like, you were talking about how a Red Tory is a sellout, and for me, a Red Tory is kind of like someone who's unwilling to, you know, stand and fight. And to some other person, a Red Tory means something else. It means whatever we want it to mean. And because we don't really know what we're standing for, what we're doing here in Canada or in Ontario, we have a lot of words and ideas that kind of mean whatever we want it to mean. So it's hard to get everybody on the same page as a result. There's not something that really unites the anger and opposition towards Kathleen Wynne, which is what she knows and what she takes advantage of.
Well, until recently, right? Because I would have thought that people would be more unified in their anger towards her because...
Over what?
Just the polling of her approval rating, right, is so low, so I thought people must be...
She is unpopular, but... Yeah. The reasons for her unpopularity vary. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Like, I don't like Kathleen Wynne because, and we'll get into this, because in my day, like, one of the reasons why I don't like Kathleen Wynne is in my day job, I'm a pharmacist, and the Ontario government has done a lot of things to hurt pharmacy and mess with the healthcare system. But you're not working for the healthcare system. So if I start, as I will, talking about all the reasons why I think the Ontario government has missed the boat on healthcare, that's not going to affect you in the same way as whatever your issue is.
Mm-hmm.
So both of us don't like Kathleen Wynne, but there's not really a galvanizing issue that's like, this is the issue. This is what's going to push
the... Well, hydro rates was, right? The galvanizing issue, and they've kind of...
It was, and
alleviated
then
that.
The government has kind of taken the pot off the boil with like their ad, with their 25% coming at you, you know, which we reviewed before.
And they did do polling, and I think it was between 75 or over 80% of Ontarians approved with the Fair Hydro plan.
Yeah.
So
the government knows when these issues are actually formulating. It's kind of like bubbles being formed and popping, right? Like in the economy, like the housing bubble grows. Is this real? Isn't it real? How can we manage it? And the Ontario government is very good at doing that because they're very good at managing images and perceptions, and they are very good at putting forth that they're actually doing something about the hydro bills.
Mm-hmm.
They may not fool everybody, but it fools enough people to kind of like take some of the wind and deflate the bubble a little bit.
Okay. So this episode we're going to be focusing on the Leviathan that is the Ontario healthcare system.
Yeah, it very much is the Leviathan.
Mm-hmm.
Of like a completely unmanageable and really unwieldy set, not just a bureaucracy, but set of bureaucracies. And when we go, and when Kathleen Wynne when Bernie Sanders takes an interest in the Canadian healthcare system, the reason why he is attracted to that is because pound for pound, our system does work better than the American system. I'm not going to say that our system is worse. People are...
What about cost, though?
Well, cost per... We got to remember that the U.S. has an order of magnitude more people there than we do. So maybe...
There's economy of scales and things like that.
It's a total economy of scale, and
you
are able to cover more people with less money. Like, you're here in Canada. The problem is not with the healthcare system that that reform of the bureaucracy is almost impossible. Because in the same way as what I talked about with Kathleen Wynne and not being able to get on the same page and saying, here's what we need to do to fix the problem. Whenever you see one of these reports, like the Romanow report, which came out like 20 years ago, that says, here's what we got to do to fix the Ontario healthcare system. They come up with like hundreds and hundreds of recommendations. And if we did all of those together, it would fix the Ontario healthcare system. But you can't do all of those and please everybody at the same time. Because as I said, the Ontario government is in the process, is in the business of managing these bubbles of resentment. And if you start changing something in the Ontario healthcare system, inevitably you're going to upset somebody else. And you don't want to give the like, look what's going on with the federal government and how these federal tax loopholes have led to an upsurge of anger against the liberals. The backbench MPs are getting freaked out. And this is a relatively minor tweak to the tax system, right?
Yeah, but any disruption or any change of the status quo, right, you're going to upset a lot of people.
Exactly, because as Canadians, we have so little that unites us that when you start messing with the system as it is and something that's working kind of well, everybody starts freaking out about it getting worse.
Well, we could say it's working kind of well, but is the healthcare system in Ontario working well, really?
No, but it could be a lot worse. It could be the way it is in the States, where people get turned away from emergency rooms and all these other horror stories you hear about.
But I mean, it's working for now, but if, like we were talking about last episode, that the budget is out of control and well, I guess they've cleared the deficit, but I mean, they cooked the books to really.
They cooked the books, right? They moved money around, they played the shell game, so they could say, it looks great, but it looks great to them.
Yeah, but our number one cost is healthcare in Ontario, right?
Sure.
And then we also have debt, is like paying off the interest on our debts.
Right, but practically, like, let's come up with a simple solution that cuts through the crap and says, here's what we're going to do about healthcare system spending. Let's say...
But the recommendations usually, do you remember what they were? I mean, there were hundreds of recommendations, but were part of them making significant cuts to, like, the bureaucracy or the amount of coverage?
All right, well, since you're focused on, like, the financial aspect of things, let's forget about the Romanow report, and let's bring up the Drummond report, which came out a few years ago. With respect to the reform of Ontario's public services, which does include healthcare. Drummond report. Some of the suggestions are, consider fully uploading public health to the provincial level to ensure better integration with the healthcare system and avoid existing funding pressures. So that basically means you're taking a lot of stuff away from cities and putting it onto the province. So that's going to create a whole bunch of headaches, and they don't even really go into that in a lot of detail. To cut specifically.
And when we hear that as, like, conservatives, making it more centralized usually ends up lacking, or they end up addressing fewer problems, right? Because they're not on the, or they mismanage, because how can some centralized power know what's best for each region, right? Like,
yeah, and remember that the health budget was, the province was cut significantly in the 1990s under Paul Martin. And people did not find that to be a very, that was useful from a fiscal conservative perspective, but it really, like, a lot of people have very bad memories of that, and it's unlikely that they're going to go back to that anytime soon. So broad-based spending cuts is not what's being recommended here, but even any kind of, like, tinkering around the edges can be very, very difficult. Like, for example, as a pharmacist, I constantly interact with patients over the age of 65 who have to pay off their $100 deductible. Now, what this means is they have to pay the first $100 of prescription costs, but all prescriptions are not covered by the government. That introduces another wrinkle. And some prescriptions don't cost over $100, so they'll actually pay off this deductible in installments of whatever the prescription costs.
In a few months' time,
In a few months, depending on what they're taking. So I'll have to sit down and explain to them, okay, so you're paying full price for this medication because it's not covered. You're paying this much for this medication because it is covered, but you haven't paid off your deductible. And already these poor seniors are, like, most of them are way, I don't, like, some, a lot of them do get it, but it just takes so long to explain this basic, simple idea that you have to pay a health insurance deductible effectively. They don't know why there's a health insurance deductible if we have an allegedly public system. They don't know why it's $100. They don't know why it's the same every year.
And it is kind of, well, not that part, but what's covered. There's what's so many arbitrary rules, right?
See, the province has a list of drugs they cover, and they cover drugs for specific reasons. So let's say I have a drug that's covered, but it's only covered for specific conditions. So the physician has to write on the prescription a little 2 or 3 digit number called a limited use code. The physician constantly forgets this. So we have to spend more time faxing the doctor and calling them and saying, could you please put the limited use code on the prescription so that it can be covered? Then we got it covered, and the senior still has to pay off the deductible. So we got it. So all we did was pay down the deductible as opposed to not paying down the deductible. So we save costs to the patient, and you can see how this is quickly spiraling out of control. And this is just one, like, this has happened to me several times a day.
And it depends on your age, too, right?
It depends on your age, depends on your income. Then we have the Trillium program. We have people, and then the Trillium people have to pay huge deductibles sometimes because it's based on their income, it's based on their prescription costs, and I have to constantly print off forms for these people to fill because they can't figure it out themselves because they have to navigate government websites. There's the there's a program for refugees, and there's a lot of resentment because the refugees get more stuff covered than people who've lived here for a while, and of course that upsets a lot of Canadians because, you know, they get the sense that the people who just came here are jumping the queue. And as the pharmacist, I'm getting a lot of blowback from people as a result of it, and I don't blame any of these people for being upset. But there's no way that I can explain it to them in a rational way and have them get it because it's not what they're thinking. They're not expecting to have to pay anything because they've been told their whole lives the system's free. Like, you know, Bernie Sanders would have you believe.
And on top of that, you're going to have another subsection of the population, people under 25, right? They're going to have a pharmacare plan too?
Yeah.
And what drugs will be covered and what won't will be...
The government says that the Liberal government, again, being masters of image management, say they're going to pay for all medications for people under the age of 25.
And that was kind of like a last-minute thing they added, right? It wasn't even included in the actual budget that they released earlier this year.
Yeah.
And basically it was just a response because they're kind of copycatting a lot of what the NDP proposes,
again,
right?
Because classic Liberals. Like, Liberals love to steal ideas from the NDP, and they like to play sort of a game of ratcheting up with the NDP. The NDP said that they were going to introduce universal coverage for everybody because there are 2 million people in Ontario who don't have coverage. Like, they don't cover for the Trillium program. They don't cover for under their parents. They get, like, private plans through their schools sometimes, like university students or, like, babies. Right now, like, there will be coverage once these changes are implemented. But as of now, there isn't coverage for them. They're not...
For babies? Sorry.
Well, like, for newborns.
Yeah.
There isn't coverage for, like, eye drops or something like that. And parents typically have to pay out of pocket unless the infant is covered under their private health plan.
Or if they're from maybe like a low-income family.
Or a low-income family, So there's like a bunch of criteria that you have to meet in order to be covered. So is it really a universal healthcare system? Absolutely not.
So do these people have to be aware if they have coverage? Or you just let them know?
Half the time, they're supposed to get letters in the mail, and then they throw the letters in the mail because they don't know what it is. Then they have to pay, and then suddenly they're very interested.
So like a low-income family might... just buy the eye drops not knowing that they actually are covered?
Well, if you're, like, in my job as a pharmacist, I'm constantly telling people, this is covered for this reason, this is not covered for that reason, you can try this, you can try that. And
so
I
on top of having to know, like, hundreds if not thousands of drugs, you also have to know who's covered
and why are they covered, and I have to be on the phone.
Is there a computer to, like... prompt you on, like, or give you...
Well, I can tell by looking at it, but, like, it makes about as much sense as, like, a bank teller explaining stuff to you as they're standing there banging away on their terminal. Yeah. Or someone at the airport explaining stuff. Like, I have to translate what I'm seeing into language that a person can understand. And I'm constantly running into communication problems. Like, we're not even thinking about people who don't speak English all that well. Or don't understand English all that well. Like, can you imagine having to explain all this to someone who doesn't even understand language?
Yeah.
Right. So,
but a lay person's not going to understand.
The lay person, like, I mean, you can sort of, like, do, if I had, like, 20 minutes to explain this stuff to people, I could, but I'm running through several hundred prescriptions a day, and I don't.
Yeah.
So, this is the reality of the situation, and most pharmacists and most healthcare workers, they have their heads down to such an extent that to be able to stop and explain it is just not a muscle that they worked. They're spending time trying to make sure they know their therapeutics and that they can get their jobs and their basic tasks in the day done.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really have time to stop and have a discussion with a patient about health calls. Luckily, I can do it because I've had practice, but most people coming out of pharmacy school, they have trouble articulating this in a way that a patient can understand. Like, they know their jargon and their terminology, but again, there's a problem of communication.
So, when you're talking about the seniors, they have to pay the deductible each year, right? Can you describe, like, it's August 1st, right? Is when that
August 1st,
yeah.
is when the seniors have to pay their $100.
And it's the worst day for pharmacists.
They roll. I don't want to make it sound like we're getting bombarded with anger from our patients and that they're just being unreasonable. But suddenly, they've been paying either $4.11 or nothing for their prescription because they've already paid out their deductible. And here it is again, and this gentleman is in his 80s, may not have the sharpest memory. Right? So we have to go through it again and explain what I already paid, this $100 you did last year. And then we have to tell them that it starts again on August the 1st. And then they're upset because they've been, you know, they've been and they've paid so many taxes. Why do we have to pay for anything? So we have to go over them with that. And then you have
A lot of them are on tight budgets, too.
Some of them are on tight budgets. Others have private and public health care plans. So the money goes through the private plan, the public plan first, public first, then private. Then whatever's left, they pay cash. So then I have to take out the receipt and literally go over it with them and explain why they're paying this much for this drug, but not so much for that drug. Canadians believe that their healthcare system, it's something they're very proud of, and they think that it should be free. And they don't like the idea that this government, this doctor is in this to make money. Right? They believe it is an altruistic enterprise, and it should be to some degree. But when they find out that doctors need to take home money or use money to pay their employees or whatever, they're saying, wait a minute, why, like, it doesn't really fit. It's another one of these communication problems. Like, yep. They understand it to be one thing, and now these doctors are, like, why are doctors making a lot of money when they're supposed to be employees of a public healthcare system? And point is that doctors, because they're incorporated, they're in private practice.
Well, and they also invest a lot of their time and money to become a doctor, right?
Yeah.
So there should be some sort of financial reward for that at the end of it, right? Like,
but it
there
comes
needs to
across,
be some sort of incentive.
It comes across as poor little rich doctor. It sounds like, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really doesn't work well for the PCs, and they have done this to, like, really stand with doctors and pharmacists make a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's true. So if you have the problem that the business owners are doing now in their fight with the government and the doctors is like, well, this is an organized group of people defending the interests of big business. So suddenly doctors are big business.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that and this fight that Bill Morneau is having with the doctors and the small business owners, this is something they've tried before and they've won with the pharmacists and with doctors in Ontario. And this doesn't really solve the problem. Like, again, this isn't going to fix the problem of healthcare expenditures. And a doctor's fee, people don't know why doctors are charging fees any more than they know why banks are charging fees. Like, you ever seen somebody get, like, really pissed off over, like, a $2 bank fee?
Yeah.
And, like, they're mad about that, but they're not mad about, you know, billions of dollars going elsewhere, right? It's like,
it's like we said on the other episodes, right? It's all about the bottom line.
Yeah.
What they're personally being charged, right?
Right. And again,
these billions of dollars are just an abstract number that no one can really wrap.
Yeah, the death of a million is a death of one is a tragedy. The death of a million is a statistic.
Yeah.
The Ontario governors were upset about, you know, a new fee schedule that was being imposed on them. Again, not with the consultation of the doctors. Same as our business people up in Richmond Hill we're talking about today. Same idea is like the government just kind of goes ahead and does its thing without really talking to people and sitting down them at the table. And then there were several rounds of negotiations, and the Ontario Medical Association was accused of being government shills, and then they kind of like they overturned their heads, and people started focusing their anger on the OMA instead of the government. And once again, you have people in different groups congregating, making decisions, and then coming back and attacking. And they're saying, like, are we shooting at the OMA board now, or are we shooting at the government? And is the government working with the OMA? And is it a conspiracy going on here? Because no one is on the same page, really. And, like, misunderstandings develop, and then people get mad at each other. And before you know it, it's like doctors are swearing at each other on social media. And then doctors are swearing at each other on social media. And then suddenly,
which is not what you expect.
Not what you expect, because
from the doctors.
Doctors are supposed to be professional, and so are pharmacists. So when, you know, people get mad and they lose their cool over this stuff because it affects their livelihood, then suddenly the government's like, okay, well, you know, you just made our case for us. Thanks. Like, this is why we're regulating you, because you don't know how to behave.
And it wins them popular support, right?
Exactly. And you talk about, like, the Ontario Liberals, they hate Trump. They don't like, they say that they don't like Trump, and they are terrified of populism, whatever that is. You ask them what it is, they can't tell you. But soaking these doctors and these pharmacists is populism. It doesn't really solve the problem. It plays to perceptions that are inaccurate, that government, that soaking doctors and pharmacists. It's
pandering to base.
Pandering to base, right? Instincts. Yeah. It fuels resentment. It fuels people's hunger for, like, you know, a class war, such as it exists. The NDP thing can't really speak out because they don't like the fact that there is money in the healthcare system, private money.
Yeah, so I mean, it shuts up their main competition.
And the PCs, if they want to be seen to be defending or
opposing the
rich, and on the other hand, the PCs are, what's up, PCs? You guys are supposed to be about cutting spending. Well, we're cutting spending and you're opposing us, so WTF. Mm-hmm. So it's an easy, easy win for the Ontario government. And, you know, despite being very intelligent people, and despite going to school for a very long time and for actually being very good at politics once they figured out how the game is played, a doctor is the same as you and I when it comes to fighting these government. The government's sitting on top of the hill and everybody else is at the bottom of the hill trying to climb it. This is what the Wynn government doesn't understand. They are actually behaving, or maybe they do understand, they don't say it, but maybe they do understand it, but they are doing the same thing that all these populist politicians are. And instead of whipping up resentment based on race or whatever, they're whipping it up based on earning and income and class.
All right, Josh, here's from an article that was in the National Post entitled, "How Healthy is the Canadian Healthcare System?" So I just want to read a couple paragraphs. And it's not just accessibility that is the problem. Against measures of effectiveness, safety, coordination, equity, efficiency, and patient-centeredness, the Canadian system is ranked by the Commonwealth Fund as mediocre at best. We have an expensive system of healthcare that is clearly underperforming. Another major challenge for Canadian healthcare is the narrow scope of services covered by provincial insurance plans.
Yep.
Comprehensiveness, in quotation, of coverage, in fact, applies only to physician and hospital services. For many other important services, including dental care, out-of-hospital pharmaceuticals, long-term care, physiotherapy, some home care services, and many others, coverage is provided by a mixture of private and public insurance and out-of-pocket payments beyond the reach of many low-income Canadians.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying. Like, that's what this NDP PharmaCare plan is supposed to address, because for all of its much ballyhooed qualities, a lot of people are completely left out of the Ontario healthcare system, right? And like you say, their comprehensiveness. And what does comprehensiveness mean? What does universality mean? It means what the government wants it to mean, and enough people believe it.
So that's when you actually look at it, it's opposite, right?
When
it's
not
comprehensive at all.
Like, if
it's
not universal. If you actually want to do the work that Canadians and Ontarians don't want to do and become engaged in exactly how their politics works, I mean, if you're like us, like, we are thinking about how Ontario government and politics actually works. And as we look into this, we get more and more horrified because...
And overwhelmed.
Just, yeah. But at least we're making our way through. Most people give up. Like, they're not doing the no-win scenario podcast every week, you know? So we're performing a very valuable service to the people of Ontario. Most of us are like our people up in Richmond Hill, who I saw today, who are looking at that truck with Kathleen Wynne's face in it and going, you know, they're all the same, eh? It's a banana republic, but what are you going to do, eh? That's where most people are at.
Of them don't even know who the other candidates are.
No, they don't know who Patrick Brown is.
Yeah, they haven't even read about it.
Understand
the issues. So, like, already jumped to these conclusions.
You want to get mad at these people and tell them to give their heads a shake, but, like, what it is legitimately confusing.
Yeah.
To the point where people are just like, okay, I guess the system works. I'm not dead or whatever, right?
But like I was saying too, last episode, right? Like, we could become a banana republic or just like a Greece type situation if we don't address like these out of control expenses, right? Like,
is it really out of control compared to America and Trump with, you know, what's going on down there?
Well, we're the most indebted sub-sovereign nation, though, right? Ontario, at least, so...
What is a sub-sovereign nation, Graham? If you argue with liberals, they will say, no, we don't have as much debt as California, according to our definition of what debt is, or what the deficit is. And look at what we're doing to address that. We are making things fair for patients by cutting doctors' fees. And the PCs are trying to stop us. So you can't trust what these people are. Vote what these people are talking about. Vote liberal. They believe what they're saying. It's like it's like 1984, right? Two plus two is five.
It's groupthink, a lot of it, right? It's
because just, they spend a lot of time. They like the PCs hang together with their people, and they have their view of the world. Where Kathleen Wynne is sitting in trial or on trial or whatever it was, and then the liberals are like, no, she's not sitting on trial or in trial. And in that case, they were closer to reality than the PCs were. But on this issue, where costs are out of control, the PCs are more are closer to reality than the liberals are. However, the liberals are able to spin it in such a way that, you know, you play on people's fears and emotions and change the definition, a few definitions of words, and it doesn't look as bad as the PCs are making it out. So then they point at the PCs and like, you're alarmist, we don't need to listen to you.
All right, going back to just the system in general and how it's becoming more and more central planned, right? For the most part. I just want to read a little excerpt from one of Terrence Corcoran, who's a columnist with the National Post, on Ontario's Minister of Monopoly.
Is Monopoly? The title?
Yeah.
Like the game Monopoly?
I think he's just saying that it's a monopoly system, right? That everything's controlled by the government, so
effectively, because they're the only ones who have a clue what's going on, like,
and or like even where there was like a little bit of, you said that pharmacies or pharmacists, they were getting allowance fees or something.
What they were getting was, and this, they were getting generic allowances from the drug companies, right?
For like, product placement, right?
To an extent, but a lot of that money went into overhead and running pharmacies. Like this complaint about overhead that the doctors are talking about and employee costs. I mean, the money we're taking in from people's prescriptions shouldn't be going to that, ideally. Like, we don't want to be pocketing the salary of people, of the money that people are giving to us. We want to return, we want to put like as little of that in our pocket as possible and as much of it into delivering the right outcomes for patients.
Yeah. So, socialist healthcare, anything socialist generally, just in incremental steps, eradicates capitalism and competition, right? And that's just one example right there. So
it's hard to tell people, we gotta be worried about dollars and cents when people's lives are on the line, right? That's how people who defend, say, the Cuban healthcare system is like, the Cubans have a better healthcare system than the Americans because it's not about private money and about greedy insurers, right? And it's the same idea with socialists capitalizing on resentment towards rich people and to the people who put profits before people.
But if you look at...
It's a myopic focus on money.
But isn't there an argument to be... Or, like, isn't there an argument that the American system's better at innovation because there's the push for competition?
Sure, and Canadians are terrible at innovation because there isn't that push for competition. Yeah. There's a push for togetherness.
And when you say it's a better system, it's better system generally, but the American system, at least, you have the best of the best, right? If you have the money for it.
Exactly. You cannot, like, being creative. Like, creation is messy, okay? And you can't
be... Hard work.
It's hard work, and it involves conflict and sacrifice. And, like, to create a beautiful work of art or to run a marathon and win and, like, really exceed on a global scale, you have to... It's not a friendly, kumbaya-type experience, right? It's hard and it's difficult. And that is at odds with how Canadians see themselves. Like, we would rather all get together. And, you know, we have disputes between these people, but in the end, we all get together, darn it. And, you know, diversity is our strength. Not, you know, not. And in the States, you have competition. It's a fact of public life there. And that's why there is more conflict and strife. But as a result, there's more innovation. So it's kind of a trade-off. And what kind of healthcare system do you want? Do you want one where everyone's where everyone's happy with the system despite the obvious flaws, or do you want a system where people are pissed off with the level of the care they're getting, and are willing to fix the flaws because there is that American spirit of innovation and competition? So that's the difference.
Well, yeah, and So Terrence Corcoran, in talking about our system, he says, the hallmarks of central planning are maldistribution of resources, inadequate supply, shortages, waiting lists, lineups, price controls, and breakdowns. If the economic history of command and control teaches anything, it is that you can't put patients first by putting the suppliers of patient care last.
Well, yeah.
That kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, you're not, like, if you're putting the suppliers of patient care last, it's like, the idea is that you should be able to deliver excellent care for no money because, well, you know, it's good to just treat everybody. It's idealistic,
yeah.
And it's selfless for me to go and dispense prescriptions all day without being paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
But
wasn't there an exodus of doctors, too, in the past with Senior Trudeau?
I think. Well, they talked a lot about the brain drain to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But that was because Trudeau prioritized a system where people put the profit motive last and put care first. And people were thinking about, as soon as you tell people you're removing the profit motive and you're this idealistic, you're shooting for this idealistic Obamacare universal system that isn't really universal, but you're trying to do it. People are on your side. Like, if you tell people hard truth and say, look, you got to pay for better quality, mm-hmm. they don't like that because that means some people aren't going to get the best quality. Like,
well, we're talking about life and death here, right? And, like,
yeah, and people.
And health, and people think that, like, oh, it's heartless to put a price on that, right?
Like, yeah, unfortunately, like everything else, you have to, like, the piper's got to be paid at some point.
Well, and the anecdotes you hear too, like even in the States, right, with like Jimmy Kimmel is really resonated with a mass audience because it's like, oh, I'm rich and I was able to pay for my kid who had like needed a heart transplant, right, at a very young age.
It offends like, people's basic sense of fairness.
Yeah, and then he's like crying on his show, right, like thinking about other parents who couldn't afford to do what he was able to do.
Yeah,
right?
Doesn't he look great? Like, doesn't he look so selfless and caring? And I'm like, buddy, where were you? Like, this is not a new problem, right? Like,
he
looks, it's very hard to stand up against that. You have to be like Ben Shapiro or someone to even really be in an intellectual space to say, yeah, here's the problem with what you're saying.
Yeah, it's just, oh yeah, get behind this universal healthcare system that really isn't universal, but
no.
But it'll we're going to save
it
kids.
It feels
so
better.
That, yeah.
And you're not really going to save kids. You're going to have
a crappier system for
you're going to convince people, or people are going to buy into the fantasy of fixing kids, of helping kids.
The pharmacists, there's all these factions, right?
Okay, so we've got, like, even within the pharmacist world, there's hospital pharmacists, and there's community pharmacists, and there's industry pharmacists, and there's pharmacists who work for the government. So there you have four groups of people, and they're all like...
Do they all have their own associations and things?
There's the Canadian Society of Hospital Pharmacists, and then there's the Ontario Pharmacists Association, which represents hospital pharmacists too. And, you know, then there's the Ontario College of Pharmacists, which handles discipline and actual fees and licensing and stuff like that. But the Pharmacist Association is supposed to push for pharmacy at the government level. And, you know, they're kind of like what the OMA does. And then you have, basically the hospital pharmacists and the community pharmacists sit at different tables in the lunchroom and kind of throw paper planes at each other. Like, there's a lot of measuring of ability. Like, I fill this many prescriptions an hour. Oh, yeah? Well, I fill this many prescriptions an hour. So it becomes a lot of disparage my colleagues, but a lot of talk at pharmacy conferences are like that. And it's less about what can we do for the profession and more about, you know, how great am I that I can work a 12-hour shift without going to the bathroom. So there are a lot of factions even within pharmacists. And then sometimes the OMA and then the OCP and the OPA and the CSHP and the whole alphabet soup are at odds with each other. And they don't know, like, how to get everyone on the same page there, which takes a lot of time. And because we don't want to offend or upset anybody because we're good Canadians. We don't want to have innovation or creativity because, you know, that's what they do down in the States. And look what goes on down there. And then somehow, and I remember once when I was in pharmacy school, the head of the Ontario Medical Association said that allowing pharmacists to prescribe would be like letting a flight attendant fly the plane. So that was what got all the pharmacists together. They were like, oh my God, the doctors don't respect us. And then there was like they went home and they cried into their pillow for a little bit, and they're like, my God, the doctors don't respect us. What are we doing as a profession? And the obvious answer is to talk about what pharmacists do, but that would involve everybody getting on the same page and actually working together beyond, oh my God, the doctors dissed us. Isn't that terrible? And then the nurses say that the nurses have their own problems with the pharmacists because they don't make as much. That's a massive oversimplification. But the nurses know their stuff, and like then some nurses don't know as much about medications as pharmacists do, so they're constantly calling pharmacists and hospitals with questions. And so when you have to explain to somebody what, you know, bisoprolol is for the 100th time, you're like, God damn it.
Yeah.
And then that just kind of fostered division because, you know, this nurse is asking questions. She doesn't know what's going on. The pharmacist is like, she has to answer that question for the 100th time. And you have like a tone in your voice. And then the nurse is like, oh God, the pharmacist was mean to me. And then there's stuff the pharmacist doesn't know. And then there's dynamics there. There's just, if there's a way.
And does the government really understand how the system works either?
They don't. Right. And even if they did, it's like what Mr. Corcoran was saying, because they're kind of like, they're like, screw this. We're going to admire, you know, Trudeau said, I admire China's basic dictatorship. Well, this is why he admires it, because he can just say, I'm going to get this done and everybody's going to do it. Because you don't want to be fighting, you don't want to be wading into this like this battle with this pharmacy group talking to the doctors group and the nurses group over here and just trying to make sense of this stuff. You want to be able to just legislate and get the thing done, damn it, after a while. Wow. Because you're just so sick of this.
So Dr. Eric Hoskins,
yes,
the Minister of Health for Ontario, he came out with the Patients First Act, and that's kind of what Corcoran was addressing.
It's the Patients First Act. The patients first, not, you know, rich, greedy doctors or drug companies, but the patients first.
Yeah. So it's going to give more power to the minister, right, to oversee everything?
You gotta trust the minister to make the right decisions, because if you trust the government, you can't trust those private people who have their profit motive. It's not like the minister takes home a big fat salary. It's not like like Hoskins is not used to, you know, jet setting around the world and looking great because he goes into war zones and treats people there. There's no self-interest there. Like, perish the thought. You cannot accuse the man of, butter would not melt in his mouth. And his hair looks so wonderful in those pictures. Like, just, wow. Eric Hoskins, superhero. And you wonder why the guy is an outsized ego, right? It makes sense when you think about it like that.
Especially with when he has that much power that he's gonna give himself to, right?
Yeah.
What do you think will be the consequences then? Like,
eventually the bill's gonna come due and it's not gonna be pretty. But as long as we can stick our heads in the sand and worry about important issues like whether Kathleen Wynne is stepping in to protect us from racist video games.
Yeah, okay,
let me explain what I'm talking about here. So we have a video game developer up in Markham, Ontario called Big O Tree Games. That's Big-O-Tree Games. And they came up with a video game called Dirty Chinese Restaurant. And I haven't really familiarized myself with this game because it's pretty racist and I don't really want to learn about it.
It's kind of hilarious though too, right? It's just...
Graham, how dare you?
What, we can't just have a laugh at this...
Well, what you can laugh at.
It was made in Markham. It was probably made by Asian video game developers. Is that too much of it?
You're walking on very... Well, I'm telling you right now, Graham, because the premier took to Twitter.
I forgot where I am right now.
The premier took to Twitter, and so did the mayor, and so did Patrick Brown, and all
the embodiment of the nanny state.
All of the politicians took to Twitter to denounce Big O Tree Games and Dirty Chinese Restaurant to make it clear that this type... And this is what Kathleen Wynne wrote in her tweet. This kind of... There's no place for this kind of racism, implying that there was a sort of racism that was acceptable here in Ontario. And it's so great that Kathleen Wynne, who has to deal with all these trials and scandals and mismanagement and a healthcare system that's running itself in the ground, has the time to cut through the nonsense and say, you know what? Video games about Chinese restaurants and where cats and dogs are being captured unfairly and cut up and turned into meat, this will not stand in Ontario so long as I'm premier, damn it. It's great that we have a line in the sand somewhere.
Yes.
So I mean, if you wanna be okay with
she's protecting us all.
She's protecting us from threats severe, like the threat of bigotry games and dirty Chinese restaurant. This is where, this is what is the threat in Kathleen Wynne's mind. She has to make it clear to everybody that she does not, she's not okay with this type of racism, and she's got to make it super clear, and she's got to cut through all of this nonsense, and you know, this is not...
This is where she thrives, right?
Well, I mean, it could one interpretation that some, you know, disingenuous and rather, you know, silly people have put forward on Twitter is that, you know, this was a troll by Big O Tree Games to try and get a reaction out of politicians to kind of boost themselves and their video game sales.
I mean, it's just, it's a frivolous issue, right? In my eyes, like...
I mean, good luck defending that. I mean, I'm sure people are going to be like, what, you don't think that, like, racism against... You think China, racism against Asian Americans is okay? Like, you can already see, like, the pitchforks and the torches, you know, coming out. You know how this goes, okay? I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. So you can have your...
Have my laugh now.
You can have your laugh now, but, oh, boy, the bill's going to come due, Graham. Just like it's going to come due for the healthcare system and all the rest of it.
I don't know what to add to that.
No, you don't have to add.
I condemn them as well, but it's really not...
Okay, everybody, Graham condemned bigotry games and dirty Chinese restaurants. We can all relax now. Everyone can go back to, you know, not caring about the healthcare system scandals or whatever, because we finally got Graham to renounce his pro-dirty Chinese restaurant views. This is the public service provided by the No One Scenario podcast, and yeah... All right, well, let's talk about the energy sector, but spoilers, folks, it's going to be a bit more of the same with me talking about how this whole situation is very opaque and difficult to understand, and that's why the Liberals are able to play their shell game with it.
Yeah, hopefully it won't be too low energy, though, right?
No, not low energy. That's a good one. That's good. That's a knee slapper.
Well, if you start thinking about Jeb Bush, it is kind of funny.
Yeah, please clap.
Can we remember how many more days?
Well, I believe it's 218. It was 225 last time, so we've cut that by 7. It was 218 days till the no-win scenario.
Possible
no-win scenario. Hopeful. Talk to you next week, everybody.
All right, see you guys next week.